was a year ago, believe it or not, at the San Jose Mercury News. Ran a series of stories called The Dark Alliance by Gary Webb. I'm sure everyone here is familiar with them. What was revealed in those articles was the fact that there was a direct link between several narcotics organizations run by Norwin Meneses, Oscar Danilo Blandon, and Freeway Ricky Ross here in South Central Los Angeles. And there was also a link between those drug organizations, direct, and the Central Intelligence Agency, and support for the Cold War effort. It created a big stink, but it was not at all the first time these stories have ever been made public. It was not the first time that we had ever heard anything about CIA dealing drugs, not by a long shot. What was unique about the Gary Webb stories was that for the first time, there was a face put on the suffering connected to CIA drug dealing. Abraham Lincoln said that the one lady who started the Civil War was Harriet Beecher Stowe, because she wrote a book called Uncle Tom's Cabin. And everybody could read that book and know what it felt like to be a slave. From where I sit, the Gary Webb stories perform much the same functions. For the first time in the history of revelations about CIA drug dealing, there was a direct connection between CIA involvement in drug trafficking and crack babies in South Central, and drive-by shootings, and gangs, and the sufferings caused to families, and the users, and the addicts, and all the people who were enslaved by crack cocaine. Now, it was 8 months ago that there was a town hall meeting down at Locke High School in Watts, chaired by Juanita Millender McDonald, not Maxine Waters. She's a representative from Compton. And I had been at one prior meeting before that at Compton College, and I stood up there. But at Locke High School, where Director John Deutsch was meeting with the people in an unprecedented move, I stood up and confronted him directly and said, I am a former LAPD narcotics detective. I work South Central, and I can tell you, Director Deutsch, emphatically and without equivocation, that the agency has been dealing drugs in this country for a long time. And I think many of you probably remembered that. We got news all over the place with that one. I have to tell you, that will remain probably one of the most fun experiences of my whole life. I met Dick Gregory for the first time in February of this year when Crack the CIA Coalition held its rally in downtown Los Angeles. We had 4,000 people show up. And Dick pulled me aside and said that he had gotten word out of the White House, out of the Justice Department, out of various government agencies. And my confrontation of Deutsch had cost him his appointment as Secretary of Defense. He had been a shooter. Because I named in that confrontation, for those of you who saw it, three specific agency operations known as Amadeus, Pegasus, and Watchtower. We will talk about those a little bit later. Now, what's happened as time has gone on is we had this fervor for a while, and as probably you're all aware, it's like, where did the story go? Well, the San Jose apparently corrected, didn't retract, but they corrected some stories. Gary Webb is now driving 150 miles one way to work in Cupertino. He's covering dog shows and weddings and family events. Okay, and what happened to Gary Webb, one of my favorite heroes in all of this stuff about what CIA does and conspiracies is a man by the name of Fletcher Crowder. Everybody here see JFK by Oliver Stone, the movie? Mm-hmm. Remember the man, Mr. X, sitting on the bench who was talking to Jim Garrison? That was Fletcher Crowder, who's written several books. He was a full colonel inside the Pentagon Special Operations Division. And Gary Webb was what Fletcher calls an object lesson. The archetypal object lesson, according to Fletcher Crowder, is Lyndon Johnson. Lyndon Johnson was riding three cars behind John F. Kennedy. The bullets that killed him went directly over Lyndon Johnson's head. And Lyndon Johnson spent the rest of his life, and certainly his tenure as president, knowing that those bullets could have been just as easily directed at him. Gary Webb has become an object lesson. Any reporter who now may want to take on this story can look to Gary Webb, who should have gotten the Pulitzer Prize, and say he's now driving 150 miles one way to work in Cupertino covering dog stories. Get the point? There are many witnesses in this waiting to testify, and there may well be hearings, and I'm going to give you some of the current newsy stuff before I go into my material.
Michael, forgive me. We all thought Kennedy was shot from the front, not from behind.
Well, bullets went from all directions, but yes, he was shot from the front, of course. Okay, but Johnson was in that motorcade, and he was accessible with the same rifles. That's the point I was trying to make. I wasn't disparaging anything else, and I wasn't certainly saying that Oswald did it. There are many other witnesses to CIA drug dealing who want to testify, who are able to testify, and there is a mountain of evidence admissible under legal standards in a court of law to prove that CIA has been dealing drugs for a long time. In a court of law, I know we have one attorney in the room. In a court of law, one of the strongest forms of direct testimony is eyewitness testimony. Now, I was a cop, and I worked assignments both in detectives and in patrol. One of the first things a cop says when he gets to a crime scene is, did anybody see it? Are there any witnesses? Eyewitness testimony is direct evidence, admissible. I am an eyewitness to CIA drug dealing. So is my very good friend Celerino Castillo, a former DEA agent who was president of Ilopango, an air base in El Salvador, run by the National Security Council and CIA, who witnessed planes being loaded with cocaine, who was confronted by U.S. Ambassador Edwin Corr and told, stop writing reports, stop pressing for a prosecution, it's a White House operation, leave it alone. That's admissible evidence. Oliver North's diary, July 12, 1985, quote, without the Honduran military, there would have been no Contras. $14 million to buy arms, and there were a bunch of other words in there, but paraphrased arms, but continuing the quote, came from drugs, end quote. That's evidence. There's a mountain of evidence, and you're going to see some of that tonight. We're waiting to testify. The heat's being turned up, whether you see it in the newspapers or not. The Central Intelligence Agency and the Department of Justice Inspector Generals, Frederick Hitz for CIA and Mike Bromwich for Department of Justice, are compelled and have committed to come back with their investigative reports, their findings on whether CIA was involved in drug dealing sometime this fall. We're talking September or October. That is not far away. At that time, there will be hearings. Now, I've spoken within the last month to the Senate Select Intelligence Committee, and I asked them, well, what's going to determine whether these are real hearings or just like some of the sham political theater that we've seen before? Al Cummings, a senior investigator, said, the scope of the hearings will be determined by A, what Maxine Waters does, B, the credibility of the reports from the Inspector General's office, and C, public reaction. And I said, what's going to determine the credibility of the reports? He said, C, item C, public reaction. If there is no outcry, there will be no hearings when they come back and tell us there's no evidence. Okay? That's what they're preparing for. Now, the pressure is really being turned up on the witnesses. I was burglarized 2 weeks ago. They got my address book, all my phone numbers, all my sources. I have most of it copied. But they also got a complete day-date calendar record of every place I've been and everybody I've met with for the last 8 months. I had a TV pilot for which I was supposed to get paid $5,000 in the first initial payment the end of June. I've been blacklisted. The pilot's been scrapped. Any lawyer will be glad to help me if I can come up with a $10,000 retainer. Those of you who know me know that I have trouble eating on a daily basis because, my car's been repossessed and I've been through a lot of financial difficulties. Celerino Castillo's been in a traffic accident which may have been staged. Another witness, D. Caron Ferdinand in New Mexico, raises horses. All of her horses were turned loose 2 weeks ago in New Mexico and almost killed by trucks on the interstate. Chip Tatum, many of you have read the Tatum Chronicles, has had his phone shut off several times. The pressure is on the witnesses. So that's a sign that something is going on anyway. Now, we don't know what's going to happen. We absolutely do not know whether there's going to be hearings or not. Something is compelled to happen. And as Mike was talking to you before, earlier, President Clinton came back with this wonderful suggestion of reducing the disparity in cocaine sentencing for crack cocaine from 100 to 1 to 10 to 1. And Maxine Waters was absolutely eloquent when she took the House floor and said a tenth of slavery is not any better than 100% of slavery. She really rebuffed the president heavily and said, no, I want parity. The chips are being played behind the scenes. He wants to, my read and sources inside the government, the CIA, tell me that he's trying to trade all of these hearings for parity. If she gets that, that's going to be great, but I'm not so sure that she will. Okay? And also, those of us who have put our whole lives into this would like to get something, at least a chance to testify about our suffering as well. Okay, but shortly after she rebuffed him, I caught this little piece on MSNBC. And it was kind of a sidebar to the fundraising scandal. And the sidebar was how President Clinton was ready to appoint six new ambassadors to very wealthy Democratic contributors, including, and named six countries, one of which was the Bahamas. Maxine Waters' husband is the ambassador to the Bahamas. If Clinton is going to appoint a new ambassador to the Bahamas, he's going to have to fire Maxine's husband, isn't he? So, they're playing the heavy stakes poker right now. That's my read on it, and many people agree with me. Now, what we're going to do is I'm going to tell you, in about an hour's worth of time, the basics of my story and what my evidence is. And then we're going to throw it open to questions. And during the course of this, I will cover some of the other bits of evidence that are out there. But don't be deluded for a minute to think there isn't evidence to prove it. It's just like with the major other cases out here that people talk about. Bobby Kennedy, Martin Luther King. There's a ton of evidence. We all know it. It's there. It's just never been admitted. So don't delude yourselves for a second. Okay. Where we go with this is going to have to be determined by a collective will, by people working together, and by some kind of group conscience forming a path. Okay? But we can't stay silent. All right, before I start with the overlays. Yes?
Is there any hope at all that with this trade-off with Maxine and Clinton, that the drug trafficking by the CIA will stop?
No, I don't see that at all. First thing, one of the first things you have to understand is that in the United States, we spend $49 billion a year on illegal drugs. That is more money per year than is spent on clothing, on housing, and on food in this country. That's directly from General Goofy McCaffrey, you know, the drug czar, okay, that's what I call it. The world spends $1.5 trillion a year on illegal narcotics. That's cash that flows through banks. It's an unmeasured part of the gross national product. And we all, whether we know it or not, or like it or not, benefit from it. How does that happen? If $200 million a month extra flows through the Federal Reserve Bank in Los Angeles, which is now regarded as the money laundering capital of the country, that $200 million lowers interest rates on loans that are charged to businesses. Businesses get loans cheaper, which generates more tax revenue, which pays municipal bonds. Do you get the picture? You can't play with $49 billion a year and not be talking about a significant part of the nation's economy. Okay. And come to think of it another way, does the auto industry have a lobby in Washington? Yes. Does the food industry, the housing industry, does any industry you can think of have a lobby in Washington? Yes. Isn't it stupid to think that the drug industry doesn't?
It's the banking lobby, isn't it?
Well, more or less, yes. I lived in Washington for a year and a half, from 1994 to 95, and I met with a number of congressional staffers and some congressmen, and I was told about, I couldn't see it, a classified report from the House Banking Committee chaired by Henry Gonzalez, which says that the six largest banks in the country would fail if the drug money was withdrawn. That's the kind of money we're talking about. That's the kind of power we're talking about. But the corruption is out of hand. The corruption is like a drunk on a bender. A guy can't be satisfied having six drinks. If he's a genuine blown alcoholic, he ain't going to be satisfied until he's passed out cold in the gutter. That's the way the disease works. How much is a little corruption? How much is enough? Since when does anybody ever stop after just making $10 million when he thinks, well, I'll quit when I get 15 or 100, et cetera, et cetera? That's the kind of process that we're dealing with. That's why it's so intractable. That's why it's so difficult. CIA has been dealing drugs since before it was CIA.
What?
Let's go back to the Second World War. And I'll do this briefly. The Second World War, we sprang Vito Genovese from prison in New York with the help of Lucky Luciano, who was capo di tutti capi, the Don of Dons. Okay. We wanted help protecting the New York docks from Nazi saboteurs. And we sent Vito Genovese to Sicily when we invaded Sicily. He helped George Patton make his way to Messina. We sent Vito Genovese up in Italy as we began to occupy Italy. And Genovese, with the U.S. government's help and the help of the OSS, Office of Strategic Services, began to revitalize a narcotics trade which was almost dead. The heroin addict population in this country during the first years of World War II was down to nothing. Zero. I mean, it was, you know, marginal. By 46, 47, it was back up to pre-war levels. Immediately after the war, with the Mafia's help and the OSS's help, the OSS was extremely concerned about communist movements in France and Italy. We turned the Mafia loose, the Corsican Mafia and the Sicilian Mafia loose in southern France and in Italy. They began to fund their operations using heroin, which was refined in the infamous heroin labs of Marseille. That money in turn funded the anti-communist propaganda efforts, the strike breakers, the union breakers. Okay, so that's 45, 46, 47. And we move into Southeast Asia after Chiang Kai-shek was kicked out of China. His troops fled into Burma. We sent in very infamous people like Paul Helliwell, John Singlaub, whose name turns up still in Iran-Contra, a great many other CIA, OSS, Office of Policy Coordination hands went to Southeast Asia, and Paul Helliwell, a banker who bought all the land for Disney World, by the way, on behalf of the Disney Corporation, was paying the Kuomintang troops with sticky bars of heroin. That was the forerunner of all the heroin coming out of the Golden Triangle during the Vietnam War. I won't have time to give you the whole history, but it runs sequentially through every major area of covert operations that CIA has been involved in since its inception in 1947. Southeast Asia and Indochina with the French, there was actually a little war at one time between CIA and the French Deuxième Bureau in Indochina over who would control a lot of the opium trade. The French were running it directly also. When the French got kicked out at the Dien Bien Phu, CIA was already moving in to control the heroin trade in Southeast Asia. By the time, of course, we had the Vietnam War, it's legendary what we were doing in Laos. Ted Shackley, the station chief in Laos, who was a prominent figure in all of my work, was funding the whole war in Laos with heroin out of the Golden Triangle. It got so bad or so blatant that Air Vice Marshal Nguyen Cao Ky, in his battle with President Diem in 1970, was shut off from access to the outside world. So CIA, on his behalf, invaded Cambodia for a number of reasons. But one was to give Air Vice Marshal Ky access to small airstrips inside Cambodia where he could fly in, land his planes, and get all the heroin being brought out of the Golden Triangle. He couldn't get it out of the country of Vietnam, so he flew it back into South Vietnam, and to whom did he sell it? American GIs. The great heroin epidemic of 1970 amongst American GIs in South Vietnam. Direct participation of CIA. Every covert operation, every area of involvement, you find the same people with CIA. All the way through Southeast Asia, from Cuba, which is where Ted Shackley and Tom Clines and Ed Wilson and all the famous guys from Iran-Contra got their starts. Through Southeast Asia, through Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan, remember the Russian invasion of Afghanistan? In 1979, 0% of U.S. heroin came from Pakistan. 79, the Russians invade Afghanistan. We set up a major support effort in Pakistan. And now the heroin poppy grows in the mountains between 5,000 and 6,000 feet where it's happiest. Lots of mountains in Pakistan and Afghanistan. By 1982, 45% of the heroin in this country was coming from Pakistan, directly correlated to CIA operations. So we get to Iran-Contra, and it's no big deal, except for this time all the brakes were off. And we find the same players we found throughout history. Richard Secord, Ted Shackley, Tom Clines, George Bush, Felix Rodriguez. Okay, I'll give you a punchline about Felix toward the end of the talk tonight. The same players are always turning up in the same places, and the MO is always the same. Okay. How did I get involved in this? Bad karma. Really bad karma. That's, I don't know what else to say. I come from a family very steeped in intelligence. My mother had been a cryptographer at Fort Myer, Virginia during the Second World War for Army Intelligence. My father was an Air Force officer, a pilot, flyer. Flew during the Korean War, got out of the Air Force, went to work for Martin Marietta, which built the Titan IIIC rockets, which put up all of the keyhole satellites for the agency. Relatives of my father had been OSS during the Second World War, my father's cousins, and Sam and Barbara both retired from the agency in the mid-80s after like 25, 30 years. So I come from a spook family. I was born in Washington, D.C. I was an only child. I was an honor student. raised a devout conservative Republican. I'm a recovering Republican, so don't hold it against me. Went to UCLA and was an honor student at UCLA, and I started interning for LAPD in 1969 when I was a freshman at UCLA. Now, my closest friend for 4 years at UCLA was a guy by the name of Craig Fuller. Craig and I were the only two living Republicans on the UCLA campus from 1969 to 1973. Craig became George Bush's chief of staff during Iraq-Contra. I was chosen to intern for Chief Ed Davis at LAPD in 1970, and exactly the same time Craig Fuller was chosen to intern for Governor Ronald Reagan. We were being groomed from very early ages for positions of power within the establishment. I was all for it. I worked at four or five divisions, but I spent about a year and a half in the chief's office at LAPD. I left as a student worker. That was what the position was called after I turned 21. I hadn't graduated yet, so I finished college, joined the LAPD in 1973, was valedictorian of my cadet class, and went to work in Wilshire Division, a place called the Jungle, down near Crenshaw and Martin Luther King. That's when Wilshire Division had the Jungle. It's part of Southwest now. And worked the streets there, and then went into narcotics very quickly, and I was being groomed. A little sidebar here. My first captain at LAPD when I was an intern was Captain Archie Bob Sillings, who had been the lieutenant watch commander at Rampart Division the night Bobby Kennedy was shot, moving people around. Two lieutenants at Venice Division, Tudor and Tackerberry, or Sergeant Tudor and Lieutenant Tackerberry, had been Metro, who had been at Central Receiving Hospital when Bobby Kennedy arrived. When I was drawn to the chief's office, my first commendation was written by Sergeant Dave Brath, who had been the chief scribe for Special Unit Senator, which wrote the RFK investigation for LAPD. Commander Carol Kirby assigned me in the chief's office. He had been captain of communications division at LAPD the night Bobby Kennedy was shot, and he showed up at the Ambassador Hotel 20 minutes after the shooting, right when there was a radio blackout, which blocked descriptions other than Sirhan being put out. When I was with LAPD and working with organized crime intelligence, I wound up working with the man who had been Ethel Kennedy's bodyguard the night Bobby Kennedy was shot. There's a pattern here that I'm trying to get to. When I graduated from UCLA, I was flown back to Washington, D.C. by my family, and I was told it was to be given a recruitment pitch by CIA. I wasn't a cop yet. I was just ready to graduate with honors, you know, Dean's List, you know, magna cum laude and all this stuff. And I was taken into the old executive office building right next to the White House, and a big guy with a CIA seal behind his head had all my package, knew everything about me, you know, and everything there, and said, Mike, the agency loves you. We want you to go to work for us. What we would like for you to do is to join the agency, become a case officer, and we will put you back undercover through the L.A. Police Academy, and being an L.A. cop will be your cover. That's illegal. Okay. So I went through the interview. I took a stack of papers about that thick, which were to fill out for my clearances, and I never sent them back. That was the end of it for me. I didn't want to do it. I just wanted to come out here to be a cop, drive fast, have fun, meet lots of pretty women, carry a gun, and just do the things that a young college graduate white guy would do being a cop. But I really wanted to put bad guys in jail. That was what that's what I wanted to do. Well, after I'm on LAPD, loaned to narcotics a couple of times. I was loaned into burglary and the homicide at Wilshire Division. And being groomed, I meet and fall in love with the woman who turns out to be working for CIA. She had grown up with the niece of the Shah of Iran, Minu Hagstrom, who was the daughter of Ashraf, the Shah's twin sister. She knew mafia people like Carlo Costello in New Orleans, and Carlo Gambino. She also knew key high-ranking LAPD people like Lee Goforth, senior detective at Organized Crime Intelligence Division, who had been Ethel Kennedy's bodyguard the night Bobby was shot. Lee was also a brigadier general in the California National Guard. Direct military connection there, and CIA connection. And I was deeply in love. And, you know, so she said, well, my people are interested in having you go to work for us. They can make your career. And I was all for it. I was in love. I had her. You know, I was promoting like a rocket ship in LAPD. But then she started talking about being in places and seeing 50 kilos of cocaine and like 1,000 M16s. Now, having worked narcotics, and I was already a narcotics expert. I had done two extended loans, and when I got promoted to detective, I was going back to narcotics. I said, man, 50, geez, if, you know, that was a lot of coke in 1976. You know, nobody really knew what cocaine was then. It was just coming on the scene. It really hadn't been. You know, and she said, our people, my people, aren't interested in the drugs. And I said, are you crazy? I said, if I'm ever in a room with 50 kilos of cocaine, somebody's going to jail. And it's not going to be me. You know? But the stories would come. And they would come in Hawaii, where she was in Hawaii and saw the guns going out and the drugs coming in. It happened in Baja California in several places. It happened in Del Rio, Texas. It happened especially in New Orleans. It happened in the Bahamas. And over time, even though I was really enamored with the fact that she was getting letters and phone calls from Tehran all the time, that the Shah's nephew would come and pick her up and take her out for dinner, that she had all this information out of my personnel package, that she knew that Daryl Gates was going to be the next chief of police, that she knew that the LAPD intelligence captains were going to retire and where they were going to go to work afterwards, I began to get the picture that there was something really wrong with the drugs, and I kept saying, I will not get involved with anything that overlooks drugs. I can't. I'm a cop, and I'm an honest cop, and I'm not going to break that. Well, she disappeared in 1977. Said somebody was trying to kill her, and it took me about 5 or 6 months, during which time I wound up being loaned. I was on staff at the academy then, to organize crime intelligence division. And getting shot at and followed and threatened and hang up phone calls. And I'm loaned into organized crime intelligence working with Lee Goforth and Norm Bonneau. And they're asking me all these questions about Teddy, and I'm keeping my mouth shut. That was her name, Teddy. And eventually, I was burglarized and my gun was stolen, and photos of her were taken. I thought, my God, they're going to kill her. So my captain, Jesse Brewer, who you may recall was our beloved police commissioner here just after the riots, the black police commissioner who should have been chief of police, just arranged my a vacation for me. He was my captain at the time. I went to New Orleans where I had found Teddy. And over the course of 8 days, I saw and met people. Now, I saw her arranging. She had a scrambler phone in her apartment, which I later described to an Air Force officer and said, that's a KY-3. It's top secret. You couldn't even have described it unless you'd seen it. She had a black night vision device. She was meeting with personnel working for a company known as Brown & Root, a major CIA contractor, which has sheep-dipped CIA personnel into it, heavy contributors to Nixon and LBJ. People on ships owned by Brown & Root were taking guns to Iran to give to the Kurds. And Kurdistan in Iran is the second largest opium growing region in the world. She was meeting with former Special Forces personnel. She was arranging also for quantities of heroin to be dropped off on oil rigs in the Gulf of Mexico. And the reason why they did that was because international ships can stop at oil rigs in international waters, take off the heroin, which bubbleheads, those are deep sea divers, would take and put down on the pilings underwater. And then service boats would sail out from New Orleans to service the oil rigs, not subject to customs search, go down and service the rigs, retrieve the heroin, and take it right back into New Orleans. All arranged courtesy of Don Carlos Marcello in New Orleans and the CIA. So over the course of 8 days, I saw all the key players. I saw her receive communication with Naval and Air Force personnel assigned to Belchase Naval Air Station. I heard her on the phone arranging for shipments of guns to be moved to certain docks at certain times. I heard her on the phone talking about picking up certain packages from certain oil rigs and bringing it in. All of that is direct, admissible testimony from me in a court of law, because from her position, it was testimony against her interest. Okay? I heard that. I saw that.
Penal interest.
Penal interest, yes. Yeah. In other words, she was basically talking about criminal stuff in my presence. Okay? That's the bottom line. I saw these people. One time I followed her down to some docks and I saw her watching a ship in some bushes. That was the second time. That was the first time I was really shot at directly. Okay. But that's all admissible evidence. Now, I was forced out of LAPD the end of 1978. I don't know how long I've been going. But I'm going to try to speed through this. Let me turn the switch.
Did your romance with her continue till then?
No. It ended in New Orleans. I said, I'm out of here. This is done. July 7th, 20 years ago, last month. Ended. Okay? I said, I'm out of here. Leave me alone. I don't want to know anymore. I don't want to see anymore. I'm done. All right? Now, I knew that my department was lying. I was forced out December 78 after the Iranian Revolution had started. And I had a tape-recorded death threat. Now, I knew that And I asked to see Chief Gates, because the guys in OCID were lying to me. The guys in organized crime intelligence I knew were CIA. There were three guys there I knew. Lee Goforth, Norm Bonneau, and a guy named John Xavier Vach. Vach was Daryl Gates' first driver bodyguard. A CIA man. Daryl Gates' first driver bodyguard. When I resigned with a tape-recorded death threat, I had an attorney, and I was smart enough and lucky enough to have planted doomsday packages in case I turned up dead. Documents were going to get mailed. People were going to get called, et cetera, et cetera. This letter went to not only Sam Hayakawa, it went to Tom Bradley, Alan Cranston, Bob Dornan, and Anthony Bielenson. Okay? Now, it says until Thursday, et cetera, et cetera. But notice what I say here. Two investigators from organized crime intelligence of LAPD, Lee Goforth, Charles Norman Bonneau, Nordica Theodora Dorsey, okay, of the Central Intelligence Agency, grew up with the niece of the Shah of Iran, Daryl Gates, chief of police. And then, in here, in the second page of that letter, that was dated December 6th, 78, we're talking about CIA, Brown and Root, LAPD files, intelligence personnel, Carlos Marcello, the mafia figures, Dan Horowitz, Hank Friedman, intimidation, okay, so on and so forth. Large quantities of cocaine and firearms in Hawaii, Mexico, the Bahamas, and New Orleans. That's the key part I want you to remember about this letter, okay? The response from LAPD and the FBI was that I was insane. I was delusional. I was a mental defective. I should never have been hired into LAPD, and I was totally nuts. Okay? Now my attorney stuck with me. I eventually went to the LA Times. And then about a year later, something really rare happened. The American press did something good. Now, this is by a writer named Tom Renner of Newsday. This was November 1579, almost a year exactly after I resigned. This was an 8-page article. Guns for drugs trade booming, reports disclose. Okay. Millions of dollars worth of weapons are being smuggled into Mexico, South America, Lebanon, so on and so forth. And what does it say in here? It says that primarily this is being run by Carlos Marcello in New Orleans, that the shipments are happening out of New Orleans, Baja California, that place is Teddy had already named, and that I had named the year before. Guns going one way, drugs going the other, both cocaine and heroin. Some going to terrorist groups, some going to armed factions like the Kurds. Over 8 pages, this is a replay of the letter I wrote a year before. Okay? So if I'm crazy, I'm also a prophet. Okay? What happened when this came out was, I finally understood in depth that CIA was actually dealing the drugs. They weren't letting somebody do it. They weren't slightly profiting from it. They were arranging it. They were getting the money. They were running and staging and coordinating geopolitical operations through the use of drug money. And the drugs were sold to Americans in this country. I picked up the phone and called Tom Renner. I said, Tom, CIA is dealing drugs. And Tom says, you're absolutely right. He says, you need to talk to a Senate investigator by the name of Bill Christensen. So I called Bill Christensen, working at the time for Senator Dennis DeConcini on the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Improvements in Judicial Machinery. There's a mouthful. And I called Bill Christensen, and Bill Christensen, a Senate investigator, says, Mike, I don't know what to do. My phones are tapped. I'm being burglarized. I've followed to and from work. My files are disappearing. Now, what this story had said was that DEA had this really secret report about all these operations of guns for drugs. And this story, Tom Renner said, also that an unnamed federal agency was sanitizing all the DIA files and stealing all of the reports linking the organized crime people to the drug trafficking. That was CIA. So I laid everything else I knew to Bill Christensen, and Christensen said, Mike, we've got to get you back here to testify. Hi. And that was the second time I was shot at. Not only did the hearings never take place, I couldn't find a job anywhere in the city of Los Angeles. Anywhere. I wound up working at a 7-Eleven store on Robertson. My second day on the job, I'm arrested by West LA Vice for drug liquor to a minor. I had to file bankruptcy a month later. Obviously, I'm onto something here. Now, what did I find out at this? Well, we're going to get to that in a minute. This is just some of the documentary evidence. You can see the date very clearly. 4/18/1980, Federal Bureau of Investigation. I got this back through a Freedom of Information Act request. You don't have to read the whole thing, but notice the where the check marks are. Rupert advised because of Teddy Dorsey's association with Carlos Marcello and a claim to be a government agent, CIA and DEA are in conspiracy with other law enforcement agencies and are allowing the Mafia to smuggle guns to friendly rebel groups and to smuggle drugs back into the country as payment for the guns. CIA dealing drugs, 1980. Okay, I've been saying this for a long time before Gary Weber ever got a newspaper story. Okay, unfortunately, a lot of us who have been at this for a while knew exactly what was going to happen to Gary Weber. I had mentioned Craig Fuller being my closest friend through 4 years at UCLA. I'm going to slide over and get my drink. I don't know if you can read that. Craig Fuller, in the first Reagan term, was assistant to President Reagan for Cabinet Affairs. He worked directly under Ed Meese. The Herald Examiner ran stories on me. This kind of proves that I know Craig. The original of this letter was stolen from my residence 3 days after I confronted John Deutsch in Watts. There are 6 or 7 letters, and I still have other originals. But the original of this letter was stolen November 18, 1996, the same day that the Senate Select Intelligence Committee called me and asked me if I had original letters on White House stationery. They were stolen that night. Okay? All right. Clearly a personal letter, wouldn't you agree? Okay. The Herald Examiner ran stories on me October 11th and October 18th, 1981. Randall Sullivan, the date's up there, but this is the first part of the story. That's the front page of the Sunday edition. It starts there. It says continued on the back page. I got the whole back page. Not one Sunday, but 2 Sundays in a row. I love this. This says that Michael Rupert, that's me, was perhaps LAPD's most intelligent officer. Can't you see it for all the money I have? Okay. So through all of this intrigue and all of this, that's a very bad picture of Teddy. She was gorgeous. I mean, she was enough to make the most intelligent man really stupid. The second part of the story, the following Sunday, starts down here. And finally, down here, the second part, and it's really out of focus, don't even try to read it, it finally talks about CIA dealing drugs. But God bless them, you know, the Herald Examiner actually said it. Now, I've written as a writer for the LA Times. I have known that David Rosenzweig, who was the assistant managing editor, for 18 years. They've never printed a word about my story. But every time I get information on CIA and gave it to Dave Rosenzweig, who was a reporter when I met him, he got promoted. Have that effect on people. Okay? Alright, so, I'm going to turn this off for a minute because I want to say a couple things really important here. Thank you. I was flown back again to Washington in October of 1981. I carried part two of the Herald Examiner under my arm. On October 26, 1981, Craig Fuller, whose letter you just saw, let me into the White House, the West Wing. I sat in his office directly under Ronald Reagan's butt. Actually, Ronald was at the other side of the West Wing, but you know, I was there. And I looked at Craig and I talked to him and we caught up on the personal stuff. And again, my awakening was very slow. I didn't realize. Now, you got to understand that what I saw was happening under a Democratic president, Jimmy Carter. Okay, it makes no difference who occupies the White House. Disabuse yourself of any such illusion. There are no two political parties in this country. And I sat there looking at Craig, and we talked, and I said to him finally, Craig, CIA is complicit in bringing drugs into this country, and it's wrong. He turned into a statue. He didn't move. He didn't blink. He didn't nod. He didn't wink. He didn't grunt. He didn't burp. He didn't do anything until I changed the subject. So we had a talk, and that was it. I left the White House, and I remember walking out of the White House and saying, where do I go now? I waited around and I went to Hayakawa's office and I went to see Dornan. Sam Hayakawa, the Republican, the former president of San Jose State, or San Francisco State, was actually a wonderfully kind gentleman. He helped me quite a bit. Nobody else did. And after a week of bashing around Washington, finding that nobody wanted to hear a damn thing I had to say, This is October of 81. Oliver North was just getting warmed up here, folks. I mean, Ollie was just really starting to get into the game. I picked up the phone and I called the managing editor of the Washington Star, and I got right through. I'm ex-LAPD narc. I'm friends with Craig Fuller, who's known in the White House. I just left the White House. Wham! I laid it all out to the managing editor of the Washington Star, and I said, CIA's dealing drugs. And he says, Mike, that's the worst-kept secret in Washington. They all know it. They all know it. They've all, always, all known it. Okay? So I came back to California. In January of 82, I did the only thing I knew how to do. I went back to my alma mater, UCLA, and I found out the ranking political science expert of the Middle East on UCLA. Notice where he's working now, by the way. Bankers Trust. Okay. I saw Paul Jaber, formerly associate professor of political science, University of California, Los Angeles. I go into his office and I start telling him my story. He says, Mike, did you know, by the way, that I was a CIA and State Department consultant in the Carter administration on the National Security Council? I said, no. I said, oh. He said, well, listen, I have all these secrecy oaths. And I can't tell you directly what you want to know, but I got to tell you, you're really on the money. But here's what I suggest you do. He whipped out a pen and he wrote down some dates and he said, go look up these articles on these dates by William Sapphire of the New York Times and C.L. Schultzberger. Okay? Go back and read them and tell me what you find. So I went and dug up the articles and I found it and I came back to him. And this is what he said I was absolutely right on. In 1975, for years before that, we had been arming the Kurds, who live in Iraq, Iran, Syria, and Turkey. They really don't have a country of their own. To fight against Saddam Hussein, who had just taken over Iraq in 1975. But we've been arming the Kurds to fight against Iraq. Why? So that Iraq's army couldn't attack Israel. Real simple. It was just part of our balance of power strategy with Israel to keep all the Arab armies divided. March 3rd, 75, the Shah of Iran and Saddam Hussein cut a deal. And the deal is the Treaty of Algiers. And then the Shah says, Saddam, I'll give you the Shah al-Arab waterway. Saddam gave the Shah the Shah al-Arab waterway, and the Shah cut off all the American aid to the Kurds. So Saddam could kill all the Kurds. March 3rd, 75. The only way in and out of Kurdistan was through opium smuggling routes. The Kurds had been a CIA asset since the Second World War. So a decision was made at the National Security Council level, and you can't say CIA and drugs really without saying NSC. A decision was made to arm the Kurds with heroin that would be sold in the United States. The NSC is the White House. What happened? Ted Shackley, station chief in Laos and station chief in Saigon, was promoted to deputy director of covert operations at CIA. Took over the covert side. Richard Secord was transferred out of Vietnam to become the air attaché to the Shah of Iran. Richard Armitage, a key player, was made a defense attaché in Iran. The same players from Iran-Contra went from Southeast Asia directly to work for the Shah at the same time that we started bringing in Kurdish heroin into New Orleans in 1975. And that was ongoing, and that's what I saw in 1977. He said, you're absolutely right. That decision was a policy decision made at the NSC at the White House. Evidence. He said it to me. Admission against interest. I've saved the map on the Middle East because we're running short of time. Oh, okay. Also evidence. See that thing officers moonlighting probed? Now the date there is 1985. Or 1984, November 17th, talks about an LAPD officer assigned to Organized Crime Intelligence Division who has been charged with moonlighting on city time and selling secrets and doing things with his city car while he's getting a city paycheck that are illegal. The guy's name is John Xavier Bach. That was Daryl Gates' driver bodyguard, who I said was CIA when they forced me out of LAPD and they called me crazy. Well, in this LA Times story about John Xavier Bach, it says that Bach was selling his stuff to a guy named Rapaski, who turned over the transcript of all the bugging that Bach had done to an employee of the Central Intelligence Agency. John Bach was convicted of moonlighting for the Central Intelligence Agency on city time.
Could you slow that down? I'm lost as to why.
This was a guy who was an organized crime intelligence when I was on loan to those guys.
Right.
Knowing that they were lying to me, setting me up to be burglarized, killed, shot at, threatened, and all the stuff that was happening. Who I said was CIA, and they said, you're crazy, he has no connection to
CIA. Why are they nixing a CIA off on a petty moonlighting charge?
Who knows why this happened? I have no idea, but it happened, and I caught it. You know? Sometimes the heavens smile on the unfortunate. Okay. Now, we get to where a lot of this stuff really broke. This is a story. This, by the way, came off an LA Times computer given to me by David Rosen's wife. Ben Bradley Jr., Boston Globe. This is off LexisNexis. A long story, 1987. H. Ross Perot said to have asked for probe of U.S. official, Texas industrialist, Assistant Secretary of Defense involved in the recent transfer of arms to the CIA for sale to Iran, was involved in narcotics traffic and weapons smuggling scheme dating to the early 70s in Vietnam. This is about Richard L. Armitage. Richard L. Armitage, by the way, is Colin Powell's white son. Colin Powell was up to his eyeballs in Iran-Contra. Okay. This story goes on for 8 pages, and it talks about Ted Shackley, Richard Secord, Richard Armitage, Tom Kline, Ed Wilson, all the CIA names we know so well, Felix Rodriguez, and how Ross Perot found out about this. Now, you know Ross Perot's not that tall. Okay, I know Ross Perot. Don't hold it against me. He's got some good points. Richard Armitage is 6'4" and bench presses 400 pounds. Ross Perot walked into the Pentagon when he got this information on Armitage and backed him up into a corner and said, you're a disgrace to this country. He went to George Bush and said, you got to fire that guy. You got to get rid of him. You can't make him Secretary of Defense. Bush was going to make him Secretary of Defense. Bush threw Ross Perot out of the White House. 1986. You think that's motive for a short, floppy-eared Texan with a big nose to run and split the Republican vote to deny George Bush re-election? Possibly. Possibly. I've spoken to Ross Perot several times. I was his press spokesman here in 92. I wrote to him, and he called me one day. Phone rings. Marcus Ross Perot, how are you? He was, you know. And he said, Mike, I want you to know I read every word you sent me. I must know 30 or 40 military officers, former law enforcement officers who have discovered CIA dealing drugs, and they've all had their lives ruined. They've been forced into bankruptcy, shot at, threatened, coerced, their wives and children have left them. They're all broke. You'd think they try something different, but they don't because it works. And then I heard a blender. And then I heard genuine anguish in his voice. And he said, you think with all of my resources I could do something about this, but I can't. They do the same thing with me, too, because it works. A guy with $3 billion. And I heard the anguish in his voice. This is also directly tied, these people, to the POWs who never came back from Southeast Asia. All right, now we're going to move on. I'm going to skip over a lot quickly, but this is an affidavit which was not written by a special forces colonel named Ed Cutolo. It's called the Cutolo Affidavit. He generated all the information, but he didn't write it because it was written after his death. There's several ways that I've proved that. Everything is factual, though. Through what is now a stack of documents that thick, Stuart sees them, several other people have. 7 other supporting affidavits, other military records and documents, we bear everything out. This is a special forces colonel talking about how he took his troops under orders of CIA into Colombia and planted radar beacons so the cocaine flights could fly below radar into Panama. Full of cocaine for CIA. And he was present when the planes were met by Mungo Noriega, Edwin Wilson, Michael Harari of the Israeli Mossad. Okay, this is a long affidavit. It talks about massive domestic surveillance and the murder of many people. 5 special forces colonels have been murdered because they tried to come forward with this. Cutolo, Baker, Rowe, Malvesti, and Bayard. About 25 other people, including Archbishop Romero, were murdered when they got too close to CIA stuff. There's a former Special Forces troop, Bill Tyree, who's in prison for the murder of his wife, who was on those missions. He didn't murder his wife. They know it's kind of like Geronimo. Okay, they had witnesses, including cops under surveillance, with Tyree under surveillance, proving that he was not at the murder scene, who saw his wife murdered by another guy, yet they convicted him of the murder. This is what we're getting, or what Tyree is getting, and you know what the black marks mean, right? The black mark means it's top secret. They won't tell you what's in it. Classified. These are all U.S. Army and CIA documents discussing the truth of the Watchtower. These are the Watchtower missions that I confronted John Deutsch with. Okay? That are all blacked out. Okay, there's page after page of this. We can prove Watchtower easily. The CIA even wrote, and you can see that's a CIA letterhead. CIA right there? Okay, CIA first said to Tyree, who's now been in prison for 18 years for a murder he didn't commit, there was no Watchtower. And this is a letter they wrote him. The date is 92, I believe. Now look at what's in the box here. Concerning item 11A, we are currently processing a request received prior to yours on Watchtower. If you wish, we can send you the same CIA-originated material, if any is released. About a month after Tyree got this, the agency contacted him and said, can we have our last letter back? Okay. There is a Watchtower. Now I want to turn to the biggest case here now. What do you think this guy did for a living? NYPD detective. Okay? Colonel Albert Vincent Caron worked on the French Connection and the Prince of the City cases. I have held this man's personal phone book in my hand. He died in 1990 of the CIA flu, chemical toxicity of unknown etiology. Okay. Long protracted illness. His brain just kind of disintegrated from within and centered his liver. I've held this man's phone book in my hands. And in it you find the names of CIA people like Paul Helliwell, General Richard Stilwell. You also, I found the home address and phone number for a guy named William Casey in Long Island, Locust Valley, Long Island. The very next entry was Paulie Castellano. You know who Paulie Castellano was? The head of the Gambino crime family. This man was the laundryman for CIA cocaine profits during Iran Contra. He was one of several. Okay, he died in 1990, and he also held the rank of full colonel. He retired from NYPD in 1980 and moved to New Mexico. Took his whole family, his daughter's son, and I know his daughter extremely well. Every record of this man when he died disappeared. His NYPD pension, his NYPD badge, his military records, his New Mexico driver's license, his car registrations, his bank accounts, insurance policies, joint bank accounts held with his daughter, everything disappeared. About $280,000 worth of insurance policies and about $30,000 in joint checking account with his daughter. His daughter was stuck with $40,000 in medical bills and not a penny left of the guy's name. Senator Pete Domenici, who's also one of the crooked and the ugly, wrote Dee and his daughter a letter saying, well, maybe he rented the uniform and he never was in the military. Okay, well, maybe he rented a uniform 12 years earlier as a major, being careful to replicate the same decorations. I don't think so. Yeah, this is one of his passport pages. These are samples of his passport stamps. This is JFK. This is London Heathrow. This is Nassau, the Bahamas. That's a money laundering site. Okay. His partner, James Robert Strauss, who I've just come across some really, in the last week or two, some damning information, had a company, now this is page 1 of 5, in a court suit. Now, there were 5 pages of travel records, and you got to understand that these travel records from American Airlines were taking place like every day. Here's the date. 9-18, 9-26, 9-26, 9-26, 9-25, 9-26, 9-26, 9-18, 9-25, all employees of Strauss, Downing & Associates. An insurance agency in Albuquerque that sells fire and casualty life insurance policies in New Mexico. Where are they going? We got 5 pages showing destinations of Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, Cincinnati, Johannesburg, Dahran, Frankfurt, Vienna, New Orleans, Budapest, Las Vegas, Taipei, Kuala Lumpur, Hong Kong, Paris, Madrid, Rome, the Jersey Islands, money laundering. Okay? I know where Strauss is, and that's something I got to hold on to, because that's something I may testify about. Now, when I went to meet Dee, and I went through all of this evidence about Corona, I listened to everything, and I gathered about 40 to 50 pages of support documentation on this guy. This guy used to come home and say, Richard Secord is such an asshole. Oliver North, if you don't forget anything, remember the name John Caffey? By the way, John Caffey is the name that Terry Reid met Oliver North under. Remember the name Amadeus, the mission Amadeus? Remember George Bush? This man talked about Elliot Abrams, and this his daughter knew because to her, Santos Tropicante was Uncle Sonny. Santos Tropicante went to Southeast Asia for the agency to get heroin during the Vietnam War. She knew a ton of New York mobsters. And she heard her father get phone calls, and it was always Amadeus the trigger. Now, she's got Strauss on tape saying that Amadeus is George Herbert Walker Bush. Okay? And I met with Dee and spent time with her, and we're really dear friends, and I don't believe that the sons of the father should be visited on the daughter. You know, she's a sweetheart. Her father was an asshole, pardon my French. Okay, but I love her dearly. And after watching all this stuff and looking at all this evidence, I said, there's only one man that I can think of that you need to talk to. His name is Ted Shachtman. He ran the CIA station in Miami that was after Castro. He ran the station in Laos where they dealt drugs. He was station chief in Saigon. He ran covert operations in Iran and Pakistan. He was involved in Iran-Contra. He is the longest-running, high-ranking CIA guy I knew of. So Dee tracks down Ted Shachtman. She finds Robert Mayhew, believe it or not, who sends her to Ted Shachtman. She complains to Shachtman about what happened. Her father had been buried as a staff sergeant, his highest rank in World War II. Within 10 days of her contacting Ted Shachtman, his headstone was changed to full colonel. And she got a copy of the order directing the change from the Pentagon. She actually stole it. Shachtman did that for her. Okay. Has anybody here heard of the Tatum Chronicles? Chip Tatum? A major CIA witness who was turning up now, who was just turned up like in the last year, okay, who was flying on missions, who flew into Mena, Arkansas, where they were, believe me, millions and millions of dollars in cocaine was being flown to Mena, Arkansas by the agency. Chip Tatum and I have been talking, and we just met recently. I mailed Chip this picture. The first picture of Caron. Didn't tell him anything about the guy. He said, Colonel Vincent. I knew him as Colonel Albert Vincent. The guy's name was Albert Vincent Caron. Everybody uses 20 names. We start talking. He describes the guy perfectly. New York accent. He says, you know, I've got to dig this up, but I've got a picture of this man taken April 12, 1985 in Honduras with George Bush. I'm waiting to see the picture. I'm waiting to see if Chip stays alive long enough to find it and get it to me, or if I stay alive long enough to hold on to it, okay, if the picture surfaces. But he identified this man as having been with George Bush. Testimony. I was there. I saw. He was posing as George Bush's doctor, believe it or not. Okay? Now I want to go to the other side of the coin. Colonel Jim Sabo. Chief of Air Operations at El Toro Marine Air Station. Now, in that position, he was in command of the Marine Corps Air Station Yuma and Marine Corps Air Station El Toro and the Yuma Proving Grounds. He came across evidence, clear evidence, in 1990 that CIA was flying drugs onto his bases. In C-130s, we're not talking about 100 pounds. We're talking about 2,000 kilos at a crack. No pun intended, okay, onto his base. He was murdered January 12, 1991. Then January 21st, 1991. They ruled it a suicide. Even though he was knocked unconscious from behind and a shotgun was shoved so far in his mouth it sheared off his uvula, and he aspirated blood for 10 minutes before his brain was blown out, meaning he was unconscious when he was shot, they ruled it a suicide. In my work, I have come across something like 190 mysterious suicides in the military. Stalin had purges, why can't we? Okay. I'm not sure they're all connected to that, but many of them I know were connected to CIA and drugs. Now, I want to stop there real quickly. Is there any evidence? Did I connect? Do you think there's evidence that CIA deals drugs? Somebody say something, please.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, I want to tell you how they're playing us. I want to read you something. And I knew this was going to happen. This is from this book. I spent many lunch monies on this $50 law book. Okay? National Security Laws. It came out just a year ago. Okay? It has many court cases relevant to national security. What I'm going to read you is from a decision rendered in the U.S. Appellate Court in Washington, D.C. Cases Hobson versus Wilson, U.S. Court of Appeals, District of Columbia Circuit, 1984, this judgment was rendered. This had to do with COINTELPRO. Anybody know what COINTELPRO is? I know Mike does. He's been a victim. CIA had a parallel operation to COINTELPRO known as CHAOS. During the war years, FBI and CIA were out to get all the dissenters, all the people challenging the government. And in this case, Hobson was suing the government, and they finally, by some miracle, extracted these highly classified documents out of FBI, which is, this is COINTELPRO, but the CIA operation was exactly parallel. This is what they found. This is what the court said. Secret FBI memoranda from the late 60s and early 70s revealed the truest purpose of COINTELPRO, and by inference, the CIA's parallel operation, CHAOS. These documents finally surfaced in this case. Quote, among the primary goals of COINTELPRO was the prevention of coalitions among black nationalist groups and between black nationalist groups and the predominantly white New Left. Thus, the COINTELPRO black nationalist program was intended to prevent militant black nationalist groups and leaders from gaining respectability by discrediting them to three separate segments of the community. It sought to promote political differences within New Left organizations and between New Left and black organizations, and to exploit opportunities to foment animosity. Quote, the result as disclosed by the trial record was at least four categories of activity interfering with plaintiffs' legal protest activities. One, efforts to create racial animosity between blacks and whites. Two, interference with lawful demonstration logistics. Three, efforts to create discord within groups or to portray a group's motives or goals falsely to the public, and four, direct efforts to intimidate the plaintiffs. When the Gary Webb stories broke, the immediate spin put on all of this was that a bunch of crazy blacks in South Central Los Angeles were alleging that CIA agents were standing on the corner of 82nd and Hoover selling drugs directly to get black people hooked. I went on the Michael Jackson show while the Gary Webb story was running, and I said, I don't know about CIA agents standing on a corner in South Central. I know about CIA bringing in thousands and thousands and thousands of kilos all over this country. A lot of it went to South Central. But you can't support the allegation that a CIA guy was selling it directly in South Central. I don't think they cared. I think they were happy to see it go there, and crack made it sell all the faster. I think that's clear. But the spin got put on. And what did the press say? And what did the Senate say? Those crazy minorities are prone to conspiracy theories, aren't they? And what did the whites say? Hey, it was just happening to them damn blacks. Well, it was happening all over the country. Ricky Ross, in the course of 4 years of dealing drugs, sold 4 tons of cocaine. That's a lot of coke, isn't it? One CIA drug ring in Mexico, Angel Felix Gallardo and Rafael Caro Quintero, were selling 4 tons a month. And those are the guys that killed Kiki Camarena. And that doesn't touch John Hull. It doesn't touch Noriega. It doesn't touch Frigoríficos de Punta Arenas. It doesn't touch all the other CIA. It doesn't touch what Celi Castillo was seeing at Ilopango. There was too much drugs just to have been sent to South Central. A lot of it was set aside to go to South Central with deliberately racist intentions, but the spin got put on that it was the blacks. Why? To keep the blacks from aligning with the whites. Because they know in Washington that this issue is never going to get solved until blacks and whites can stand and hold hands together. So what do? They keep us apart. And that's their strategy right there. You just heard it. And they're playing the same thing right now. When the Gary Webb stories got retracted, it wasn't retracted, corrected. The corrections came when the San Jose Mercury News said, well, we really didn't have enough proof to show that CIA was deliberately targeting South Central. Get the point? Hence, we throw the whole story out. That makes perfect sense to me, doesn't it to you? We're being played like suckers at a carnival. And we fall for it. We fall for it all the time. We've been falling for it for years. And I knew this was going to happen. And I said before, and it's happened within our own coalition, I said before, this wasn't about genocide. The British colonized China 350, 400 years ago with opium. What happened? How did they do that? You know why? Because China was unified with one emperor, a strong country. It had tea and silk and all these spices and all these things that the British wanted. And the emperor in the unified China said, you can't have them for the price you want to pay. So the British started smuggling in opium and hooked the population. And by the way, it has nothing to do with race, because anywhere a colonizing power has injected addictive opium or cocaine, the population got hooked. Black, white, brown, yellow, oriental, doesn't make any difference. That's a law that they know it works everywhere. So what happened in China? As soon as the British stuck in the opium, China broke up and you had all these warlords running around fighting each other, and the British got exactly what they wanted. What happened when the cocaine turned up in South Central? When I was a cop on the streets here, there were two gangs. Actually three. The Crips, the Brims, and the Pyrus. And they only fought each other. They never fought between themselves. By 1984-85, you had 100 sets in this city fighting each other. The warlords, broken up, divide and conquer, fight. And once again, they got exactly what they want. People divided, people afraid of each other, people not trusting, people saying it's a black problem, it's not a white problem. And as long as we're doing that, we're all Ben Franklin said, we must all hang together or else we shall surely hang separately. Now, I'm privileged to walk equally with respect among groups on the far left, you know, and I can walk into South Central, and I talk to Maxine's office, and I can walk into the far right. And you know what? You guys are all saying the same damn thing. The same thing. You know? I'm not endorsing one left or right. I'm still a cop just trying to put bad guys in jail. And I'm watching how all of my support and all of the people who are just so gullible are just going to let around and fish. Saying exactly the same thing. The problem is that there's many reasons to say many different things. There's many other issues. But I have always maintained that CIA dealing drugs was the easiest case to prove. And if we could just unite one time on one issue, we could crack the door with this case. Because there's a ton of evidence. I put 20 years of my life into this. Okay? And I'm not very hopeful for that. I'll tell you why I'm not very hopeful. I don't know what it's going to take. I don't know how. Some miracle, you know, who knows. And maybe I'm a John the Baptist. Maybe someday. And that's the other problem I see, that everybody's always looking for a Messiah. And I am not a Messiah. I don't want to be a Messiah. I don't intend to be. That's the wrong way to approach this, because I get tired of people looking for me to do for them what they ought to be doing for themselves. Once you guys know this, you can talk about it just as well as anybody else, because you have the same rights I do. We're all citizens. That's the common ground we start from. So I think I'll shut up there if I haven't piqued anybody's interest, and take questions, and we'll go as long as you want to go. Dave, you had a question?
Yeah, you mentioned the Trafficante that was towards the end of your lecture.
Yes.
That was doing some work with the CIA. Is that the same guy that's involved in the Miami mob?
Absolutely. Uncle Sonny, Santos Trafficante, was... It was kind of a really unique relationship. Lucky Luciano, Santo Trafficante, and Meyer Lansky were like the three biggest mafia figures throughout the 40s. Santos stayed extremely powerful in the southern region. Carlos Marcelo, the mafia don, even answered to Santos Trafficante. In 1968, Santos Trafficante went, courtesy of CIA, to Laos, Cambodia, and Burma, you know, was protected by them, and that was right into the Golden Triangle. So Trafficante was also extremely involved when Castro took over Cuba in the early efforts of CIA to kick Castro out so that the mob could get their casinos back and do their money laundering. Remember I mentioned in World War II, in the early part of World War II, we had these blockades, right? I mean, we were in war. We thought the Germans were going to land and the Japs were going to land. Our borders were sealed. The population of addicts almost went away completely. So did the demand, believe it or not. Okay? So interdiction is successful. Okay? So if we can ever confront this issue, and it's going to be bloody ugly when we do, if we can ever confront this issue, we can look to a sharp reduction in the addict population. just as a result of drying up the supply. Okay. Stuart.
I had a question. From your talk, it's clear that the CIA-Contra crack connection isn't unique, and the CIA has been dealing drugs historically. Can you talk about how the crack epidemic might have unique aspects? Like, I've heard talk of, you know, coke, a lot, large quantities provided on consignment, that there seemed to be a deal between the Medellin cartel going to the east and the Contra coming to the west. Was there something different about the crack epidemic?
Yes, I think there was. And, you know, and I do have to say that I do believe that the guys in CIA were acting from racist motives, but the whole CIA involvement in drug trafficking was not specifically and exclusively directed at minorities. That's where I draw the distinction. Ricky Ross was fronted a lot of cocaine. The unique thing about crack...
But did that happen earlier with the Gambino families? Did they, with heroin,
no.
Did they operate that way?
Well, who knows how the mob worked? I mean,
was there a marketing scheme like Flandone worked out?
Okay, no. First, you have to understand the whole history, because drug trafficking is basically something that's created only by outlawing something. You can't create the trade until you make it illegal to do something. So, like it was with Prohibition and booze. That's, you know, how Bronfman and Kennedy and all of those guys, you know, made their money from Al Capone. The organized crime connections with heroin. Heroin was always pretty much a straightforward commodity. Opium, you smoked in a pipe. When you refined opium, you got first morphine, then diacetylmorphine, which is heroin. Okay? Heroin, then, you would cook up in a spoon and shoot. It's always been that way. You get a spoon of heroin, you know, and you might get two hits from a spoon, depending upon how good this stuff was. On Island Street, it's Mexican ground. That's always worked the same way, only the price has gone up and down. Okay? Cocaine's different. Cocaine was really not really well known. I mean, it was a drug used by musicians and some really wealthy people, you know, and a few eccentrics through the 70s. When I was sent to the DEA school in 1976, now check this out. The official policy of the Drug Enforcement Administration was that the least addictive and least harmful drug of all, including marijuana, was cocaine. They were setting the stage for what was coming. Okay? Cocaine at the time that I was on the street, 76, 77, was running, my God, it was probably 250 a gram. Really expensive stuff, but there wasn't much around. By the time crack appeared, coke was going for maybe 50 for a half G. Okay? Still, that was out of the price range of people in South Central Los Angeles, or poor people. Okay? What happened was that crack gave you a $10 hit, which gave you this monstrously intense high, but it wore off after about 30 minutes. It was the perfect psychological vehicle to addict poor people. Just like the little knobs of opium were. Just like it worked with GIs in Southeast Asia. You could buy some of Nguyen Cao Ky's heroin right outside of Da Nang for $2. Okay, or some of his opium, which you would smoke. Okay, or the heroin, which you would for $2. But a six-pack of beer would cost you $5. Well, shit, what's the logical choice, man? So that psychology works everywhere, regardless of the race to which it is applied. But if you got to understand this about crack. Crack wasn't some major discovery in 1980. Crack was literally turning cocaine back into what it was when it was called basuco. When they first crushed the leaves in the pit, they come out with a cocaine base. And they had addicts in Bolivia and Peru and Ecuador and all these countries in South America that would smoke the paste, and that's crack. And that was before they turned it into powder. See? So what happened when you cooked it with baking soda and ether and all the stuff that you do here to make crack cocaine was literally turning it back into the chemical form that it was when it was first crushed out of the coca leaf. So the process was very well known. Was there a genocidal plot behind that? My answer to that is I would take the same position that the U.S. Supreme Court took in the Brown versus Board of Education case in 54. What, you say? In 54, the Supreme Court said, we don't have to decide whether segregation existed in school systems as a result of an intentional act. We can say that it has, that there is de facto segregation because all the blacks live here and all the blacks live there. We're not going into the intention. I think this, I would take the same position with South Central. But 4 tons a month couldn't be consumed if every person in South Central Los Angeles was smoking 24 hours a day. That had to go to whites and Latinos, American Indians, and everybody else in the country. So that's kind of, did I help?
What do we know about the consignment? Or the
Ross was fronted a lot of cocaine. There is no question about that. That was done by Blondon. Okay. And certainly Meneses was aware of it. Ricky, you know, had been a little bit active beforehand. I mean, it wasn't like he was a virgin when all this started. You know, so they knew they had a reasonably okay player, you know, who was going to go out and sell the stuff and so on. Cocaine has been fronted. Enormous quantities, yes, were fronted to him. But see, Blondon was given orders. When CIA sends case officers out to do something, they might send 3 or 4 case officers into a country with 3 or 4 groups of agents under their control. And they might say, your objective is to X, okay, whatever it is. Infiltrate the government. Infiltrate the defense ministry. One case officer may recruit a bevy of prostitutes, female. One case officer may recruit a bevy of homosexual prostitutes. One case officer may try to get the guy gambling. You see what I'm saying? They're really goal-oriented. So CIA was put out this mission. First, Ronald Reagan and George Bush took all the checks off the national security establishment with the Contra War. They said, support the Contras and fund them any way you can. And all of these crooks from CIA had now walked right into absolute power. Okay? And the mission was to generate cash. Okay? So the CIA set out to generate cash. Blondon had marketing training, as I recall, here in the States at MIT or someplace. He had a degree in marketing, for God's sake. So he just applied his skill. His mission was to generate cash. Okay, he said, South Central, there's a ton of money down there. I can do it with crack. Let's go get it. Screw them, people down there. And that's probably the way
it went. I just wanted to throw in a few other things. Obviously there are a lot of different perspectives. And from the perspective of part, let's say, because I don't want to speak for the crack the CIA coalition, but I think that some of the things you have to look at is the period of time, what was going on in the world as this began to develop here in Los Angeles. And it's not a coincidence that they were using this to attack the Nicaraguan Revolution, because as you look at what was happening in the period, in the late 70s, as that revolution came to power, the forces that we're talking about were actually on defensive in the world. I mean, the CIA, the U.S. government, there were a lot of victories being won. You talked about the Shah of Iran. Of course, the Shah of Iran was also overthrown in that period. There was a revolutionary struggle going on in Iran, and they already had people who were working with Khomeini while they were still trying to prop up the Shah. I mean, right. These are very far-sighted people that we're talking about. The CIA had a lot of irons in the fire. So, but they very much wanted to destroy the Nicaraguan Revolution. They very much wanted to put the finishing touches on the Black liberation struggle in this country. This is the period of time when there was, in fact, a reassertion. The late 70s, early 80s, there was renewed activity of the Black Liberation Army, for example, in this country. They targeted, for example, Dr. Fethullah Shakur, who was someone who had been a leader of the Black Liberation Movement for many, many years, and in particular led something called BANA, which was the Black Acupuncture Association of North America, which was using acupuncture anesthesia as a method of treatment and detoxification for addicts. And Dr. Shakur led a movement around the slogan, you have to replace the desire to get high with the desire to be free, and was having very, very effective political and social organizing of addicted populations in the Black community. He was identified as a COINTELPRO target long after they swore that COINTELPRO no longer existed. So they were targeting the Nicaraguan Revolution because they had to break that revolution. They saw an upsurge in liberation movements continuing. This is why Ronald Reagan came in as president.
Right.
And so, in this country, in this same period of time, they did put forward a fairly open doctrine coming out of the Trilateral Commission that the problems of the United States, a destabilization they saw going on in this country, had to do with too many gains, too much democracy, what they called an excess of democracy. And specifically, they targeted Black and Hispanic populations for what they called spatial deconcentration. And this went on all around the United States and in Los Angeles. And the effect of it in Los Angeles was the deindustrialization that we've seen, the destruction of the economic base in South Central Los Angeles, and then you have a generation of young people with no sustenance except the drugs that are brought in. So I'm not saying that it was not, I agree, it was not exclusively targeted at the black community, but there was a social struggle going on in the world, and they saw very clearly that there were forces inside this country that they were very much afraid would align with international forces that they saw building up. So it, in my mind, it is no coincidence that this exact operation of crack cocaine, the Contras, guns into the, and it was not just drugs. Some of the stuff that came out in the Gary Webb article was about bringing weapons into the community to arm these warlords and to substitute. They have a very conscious strategy that's called the pseudo-gang strategy that they've put out in all their stuff about how to deal with the potential of revolutionary formations growing up, is that you create counter-revolutionary armed organizations that can create chaos. And the same thing happened in earlier periods with some of the gang activity they used to counter the Black Panther Party. So they were ahead of the curve on some of this. I do believe that they saw a potential for developments in this country getting out of hand. And if you read some of the anti-immigrant stuff from the same period, that some of these people specifically said that they saw Nicaragua as a fuse going to ignite the bomb of Mexico that would blow up in this area. So I do believe that there was very conscious targeting of the black and Latino communities. I agree that it spread out very, very widely, and I think that white people inevitably are going to become victimized in the same way, that because we live in an empire, everybody becomes a subject. That we can't, Mike said we're all citizens, but I think the fact is that none of us are citizens anymore. None of us have the prerogatives of what citizenship really means
anymore.
We're
all idiots.
Because we're living in an empire, and we're all subjects of an empire, and I think this process of disillusionment hopefully will lead us to the kind of unity that Mike has talked about.
By the way, supporting what he said real quickly, Chip Tatum has on his website, and I have the address, he has a tape that he says he made while he was flying Michael Harari and Buddy Young, Bill Clinton's director of security, who was working CIA the whole time, in which Harari says, and this is a quote, a lot of this cocaine is directed for South Central and for black communities because what we're going to do is get all the niggers hooked and put them in prison.
Yep.
Quote.
Yep.
Okay?
Yep.
Now, where, and I believe it, what I'm saying is that, oh my God, I watched the end result of that, that when something like that comes out, it's no longer an everybody problem anymore, it's solely a black problem, and we're all screwed again. You see what I'm saying? Because the drugs were going to white families as well. But, God, that's the way this disinformation works. It becomes solely something. Now, to support what you said, and this is a concern of the people on the far right, the conservatives, they're all really ticked off now about the communist Chinese, who were trying to buy the Long Beach Naval Base and turn it into sovereign Chinese territory. You guys know about that, Costco? Okay? They bought a huge parcel of land up near Palmdale. And they're going to ship tons and tons and tons and tons of goods if they get this going up an area straight through called the Alameda Corridor. Where does the Alameda Corridor run? Right through South Central. When was all that land purchased? When the property values were driven down. So we're talking about opposite ends of the same conspiracy here. Get the point? The right's worried about one part, the left's about it, the blacks over here, the whites over here, and we're all missing. It's one octopus strangling everybody. Okay.
Oh, well, it's not just that whites use drugs also, but it's who's in the prisons, and
that's a whole separate.
But it's connected.
Works. Yes, it is.
And it is. We all hang together. It's so easy for the whites to think we all hang as long as all us good, upstanding people who never went to prison because we never did anything wrong hang together.
But as long as there's
even ignore a million people, a lot of them. In prison, and it's really.
As long as there's breath in this body, I'm going to say I'm in no less danger than any black man, and vice versa. And until we recognize common peril and act from a common basis, we're all units in this fight. We're not going to get anywhere until we can find the common basis. You first, and then you, because you had your hand up longest.
I was just kind of curious why the San Jose Mercury news story came out. I've always kind of been curious. Am I supposed to think this has happened just because some news reporter, stumbled upon it and published it, or
Well, I know part of the genesis of that, and I'll tell you quickly. Patrick Formey, who runs the Center for the Preservation of Modern History and publishes Prevailing Winds up in Santa Barbara, is very tight with a lot of, with Oliver Stone and Andy Davis, who directed The Fugitive, and a lot of, you know, people with money look into this stuff. Very ardent progressives. And Patrick knew the former girlfriend of a major drug dealer and of Carlos Lederer, who was Oscar Daniel Blandón's ex-girlfriend. And she told him the story, and Patrick called Gary Webb. So I know that part of the genesis right there. Okay, and she came up with the stuff which Gary Webb started putting out. But I tell you, I had exactly the same question when that came up. Why did these stories come out? Because I don't believe, this is controlled media here we're talking about, folks. Everywhere, control. For those of you who don't know, when Capital Cities purchased ABC, William Casey was the senior lawyer for Capital Cities. Okay.
Does everybody know who William Casey is? Because
Ronald Reagan's director of Central Intelligence arranged the buyout of a major network by Capital Cities Broadcasting. Okay. The media is controlled. So I don't know. I've got a lot of questions about that myself. I wish I could answer that. I know Gary Webb personally. Okay.
Does it, what effect does it have for, like, for the CIA to suddenly come under attack?
What you're missing is the Hegelian dialectic of all of this. And the Hegelian dialectic from Hegel says that you create a problem so that you can solve the problem, and in solving the problem, get the results you want. CIA got attacked. They raised the Contra issue again because it really hadn't died. The Christic Institute in 86 and 87 was 100 times bigger than the crack the CIA coalition was. So what I'm saying is the issue hadn't quite died, but they raised it up, then they knocked it down, and while they knocked it down, you know, they created some more racial tension in the country. So I don't know how it all works, okay? Because they know better. They got access to more information than I do. Yes,
what is the logical or the hope for outcome, you know, in the work that, you know, the Crack the CIA Coalition and you are doing? What kinds of audiences, in terms of, you know, church groups, in terms of more mainstream audiences, are we hopeful and how of reaching?
Abolishing CIA would not solve the problem, but I really kind of like what Jim Garrison said, that he didn't know if he changed anything, but they sure know that they have been danced with. You know, that we're not just all rolling down, laying down, rolling over, and saying, okay, let's have some fascism. And Mort Saul was, you know, a very famous comedian for a long time. He was one of Jim Garrison's deputies. He's been fighting this stuff for 30 years, and he's lost a wife. His son just died recently. And Mort said, the road to fascism is paved with liberal intentions. And he's absolutely right. Bear in mind here, we're going to have some time, if we're not all asleep, in the next 2 or 3 months, a really major opportunity to relight this and to prove to them that we aren't victims of their mind games. Remember I said that the Inspector General's offices of CIA and Department of Justice have committed to and are compelled to come back with their reports. Now, what you're going to see in September or October is going to be CNN, you know, one of those news readers going, the Inspector Generals of the CIA and Department of Justice today announced that they have concluded their year-long investigation into recent allegations of CIA involvement in drug trafficking. Their report says, quote, we have found no evidence of any agency involvement after an exhaustive study, blah, 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 blah. Now, that's the opportunity. That's the chin. The future of this movement, the future of this issue, I think the future of free will in America is going to hinge upon what kind of reaction comes at that time. Now, we've got a couple things working in our favor. The Honorable Maxine Waters, and I do not believe she is a messiah. She is politically vulnerable. Her Records Act was just killed in committee. That was to declassify documents. But she has been a vociferous vocal pit bull on this issue. Now, picture coming back with no reports what Newt Gingrich and what the Republicans are going to say if she doesn't fight back. They're going to say, look at that crazy black bitch. She went out and stirred everybody up and there was nothing to it. She's not credible. That's what they're going to do to attack her. Do you think she's going to let that happen? She can't afford to let that happen. she's going to have to fight back with what she knows. Now, whether she fights back alone or with a lot of blacks and a lot of whites and a lot of people screaming behind her is a different story. I hope that she doesn't sell out just for parity and sentencing, because I would like a little justice after 20 years, and I know a few other people would. But the fight ain't over yet.